It is the province of integral knowledge to gather together all the elements of existence, individual and collective, find their unity in their common absolute. The divine, when it manifests, holds in itself the absolute term of everything that issues from it. And when we approach from our end, for every faculty, every part, there is a larger term in the universe, and an absolute of both in the divine. So it is in the process of working out the scheme of integral knowledge that the whole of the universe comes to be embraced. Nothing is left out. It is true, for a certain approach of the mind, that the absolute of everything is only to be found in the beyond. In time and space, there cannot be absolute. Everything is limited. But above this universe, you find the absolute. In a sense, Sri Aurobindo points out, this is true. But it is also true that the absolute does not forfeit its character for the reason that it pours itself out in terms of the individual and the cosmic. All the principles of existence are present in the universe at all levels. The principle of absoluteness also is present in principle everywhere. For instance, the principle of soul and nature. This is an ancient institution of duality, conceived and pictured differently by different systems of religion and philosophy. There are some schools which speak of the soul as the self, and nature as the power of the self, of covering itself with any number of illusions. For what purpose the self should choose to cover itself with illusions instead of truths, no system has been able to say. However, there are other schools which consider the soul as the being, the self as being, and the nature as the power of that being to formulate itself in innumerable forms and movements. There is also, as we have seen earlier in the course of our discussions, the duality of Ishvara, the Lord, and His Shakti, His puissance. He is the Lord, not only the self that stands behind, but He is the Master, and the power that issues from Him, the power that builds, does for His delectations. Then also, in the ancient Indian systems, there is what is called the Sankhya system, which many of you would have come across if you have read Sri Aurobindo's essays on the Gita. The Sankhya derives its name from enumeration. Its basic principle is the enumeration of the 25 principles that constitute existence. It conceives of an uninvolved soul, self, facing nature. Nature and soul are eternally separate and distinct. Nature goes into movement the moment the self regards it, and it goes on playing, building, withdrawing, all for the pleasure or the benefit of the soul. These souls are multiple, but nature is one. As long as the soul looks at nature, who Sri Aurobindo describes somewhere else as the notch girl, the dancer who enacts the play of the cosmos for the pleasure of the self or the soul, the moment the witnessing soul withdraws his gaze, the impulse stops, nature comes to a standstill. The Sankhyans were very clever. If they had conceived of one soul, then the moment one person achieved this withdrawal and nature stopped her play, everywhere it would be repeated. That is why they said there are innumerable souls, multiple souls, watching the play of one nature, taking its position vis-a-vis each different soul. Now these are some of the prominent ways of presenting the problem of duality, soul and nature. This duality, Sri Aurobindo points out, starts from the very summits of creation, and it reproduces itself on every level. In the essays on the Gita, this relation between the soul and nature is graphically described step by step, keeping with the growth, the progress of the evolutionary movement. First, they speak of the soul as the witness. He does not participate in the play of nature, but he just regards. No doubt, the very act of regarding is in a sense participation. If the soul does not regard, if the soul does not witness, there is no impulsion to nature to continue her play. However, even in this witnessing action of the soul, there are grades and grades. There is the tamasic witness, who is just lazy and watches without movement, without even an effort to influence or even to transcend and get away from the play. He just bears it, suffers it. That is the tamasic witness. There is what is called the rajasic witness, where the soul regards not out of helplessness, but with a certain acute interest. There is also the regard of the sattvic type, where the soul has attained a certain maturity and regards things with a certain tranquility of spirit. But the ideal witness, Sri Aurobindo points out, is of him who regards like a spectator regarding a play on the stage, drawing the full enjoyment of it, participating in his own emotions, but ready at any moment to walk off without being involved in it. This is the highest poise of the witnessing soul as far as nature is concerned. Next is the poise. Next to the poise of the witness is the poise of the sanctioner. As I said, the very act of witnessing implies a certain kind of sanction, an implied sanction, an indirect sanction. But the next step is the soul exerts itself and makes a movement of affirming the impulsion of nature or holding it back, but without involving in subsequent activities. This is the second poise, the poise of the sanctioner, one who consents. This leads to another poise, one who upholds the activity of nature. This should have come the second. After the witness comes the upholder. The upholder, he supports the play of nature without participating in it. He contributes the necessary energies for the play, but he does not follow it up by taking interest in subsequent activities. Once he enters into the situation by contributing the energies, by holding nature on his bosom, the third is the stage of the sanctioner, which I have just spoken. Once the soul starts sanctioning, it is only a question of another step before he participates in the movement of nature and constitutes himself as the controller. He controls, he directs the movement of nature as he wishes. And this action of controlling and directing the nature by the soul culminates at its highest in the soul becoming the enlightened enjoyer of nature. Not subject to nature, not helplessly subject to nature and getting whatever little crumbs of enjoyment she throws at him, but a fully conscious, enlightened enjoyer. That is the final step of soul as far as nature is concerned. All these, Sri Aurobindo points out, derive from the eternal duality that is in Satchidananda. Sat, existence, is also the existent. It's not merely an impersonal state, but it is a positive being whom you can't describe except that he exists. His consciousness, knowledge, chit, and that chit as force, consciousness force, is the prototype of what projects itself as nature in our terrestrial creation. It is the same ancient puissance from the Lord that becomes, when it devolves in ignorance, what we call Prakriti. If the Purusha is still on the heights of his self or in the inmost depths, still the divine being retains a link with the divinity from which he has issued, so also Prakriti, nature, is in her inmost depths the divine consciousness power. It was of her that the ancient Upanishads spoke, that the rishis in their meditation discovered that she is the puissance who covers up everything in the modes of her working. Even the gods are covered by the modes of the working of the Shakti. What is called Shakti in knowledge is Prakriti in ignorance. Just as the human soul in the belt of ignorance is subject to the law of nature and is ruled by nature, similarly, the power of the soul, as long as the soul is in ignorance, is also subject to the kala of ignorance. The way out of this stigmata of ignorance is first for the individual to become conscious in himself of the various parts of his being, his mind, his life force, his soul, his body, the physical. After becoming conscious, to find their link and correspondence with the universal mind, the universal life force, the universal soul, and the universal matter. Naturally, you start at the level of mind, then come at the level of the sense. You sense it, you feel it. But before you can either know or sense, you have to have the vision. That vision you get by reading books from those who have had that vision, or the vision simply dawns on you by grace. After the vision is real to you, it is translated in terms of the intellect as knowledge. from the level of the mind, you gradually render it in terms of feeling and experience. Feel your oneness with the universal terms. Find yourself in the cosmic being. That is ultimately the purpose of meditation, concentration. These are periods when you can get away from yourself, as Shri describes in Savitri, when the cherished guests of life are left outside and when the lamps of meditation are lit. You find unknown and unseen faculties coming up, finding their link with their corresponding members in the cosmos. But that is not the end. That is again only a stage. There is no attainment. Only by extending and universalizing yourself, you still universalize yourself in ignorance. You are still within the boundaries of the shadow of ignorance. That is why Sri Aurobindo insists that simultaneously, or perhaps even before, this step of extending and widening yourself horizontally is undertaken, you awake to the divinity in you, link yourself, throw your hook to the divine above, establish you are, recover your old ancient relation with the parent divine. Train your will to be in tune with the divine will. When you are that ready, when you have begun to function as a center of the divine in a human form, then it is safe for you to extend yourself, identify yourself, and emerge as the cosmic man. Otherwise, if you miss that verity, that truth within yourself, you are very much in the undergoing the risk of only colossalizing your ego. One may feel vast, one may identify oneself with the larger mind or life force, but if it is the mind poised in the ego, if it is the life force dominated by ego, then it is a titanic or an asuric development that takes place, almost suicidal. This then is the precaution. First, an individual psychic realization. Attunement to the divine will in yourself. In that consciousness, in that poise, extend yourself gradually and become one with the cosmic being. coming to questions, there was a question, very practical type, that confronts a seeker or an awakened person in the course of yoga. That is, you begin to realize certain paucity in your being, certain limitation which besets your functioning. You find it is almost constitutional with you, chronic, constitutional. When you realize, normally in outside world one doesn't realize it, one always attributes failures, mistakes to others, so the question does not arise. But once you step into yoga, there is no respite. You are not allowed to have that comforting delusion. Say, you realize that this is my handicap, this is my failing. Now, how do we set about correcting the situation? This situation arises in the lives of most of us at some time or other. We try, we fail. Now, if we fail, say about half a dozen times, is it an indication that things will remain always that, that I have to bear that cross all my life? Well, a yogin cannot take that attitude. Once you take to the path of the divine, Mother has pointed out repeatedly, every little thing that takes place in your life has a meaning. You have to keep your eyes open and mind vigilant to discover what is the purpose, why it has happened. Now, when the knowledge comes to you that this is my failing, this is a thing that I have to remedy, it means nature has brought you to the first step of remedying the situation. The first step is always to become aware of the difficulty. And in truth, in the realm of truth, whatever it may be in ignorance, knowledge always carries with it the necessary power to effectuate itself. The bane of our creation in ignorance is this division between knowledge and power. It is only at the truth consciousness level that knowledge and power reveal themselves as two sides of the same reality. Knowledge is instinct with power, power is guided by knowledge. Now, in the question, in the case which we are dealing with now, the very fact that one awakes to the knowledge that this is my defect, this is my failing, guarantees that behind that awareness, the necessary power is waiting to be drawn upon to translate that knowledge into practice. Nature always carries the means of effectuating knowledge when it gives a knowledge. In any field, the moment you have the perception, be sure that the means to translate the perception into practice is there. We may not realize it. In our wrong way of setting about things, we may miss it, but it is there. With that faith, that the reserves of the power required to deal with the situation are given to me, They will be revealed to me in due time. I set about correcting myself. Every little situation, you exert the will. You cannot say that I will do it on different occasions and not in these small affairs. Every occasion should be taken to exert the will in the right direction, to summon all the energies to remedy the situation as far as the circumstances permit. Once, twice, thrice, 100 times, the will has to be exercised and the resistance is bound to give up and the power is bound to grow to remedy.
It's very hard to see the soul and nature as a duality. It seems in reading the chapter, he links it up as one line.
At a high level of consciousness, soul and nature reveal themselves as one reality. But the moment the stage of manifestation arrives, there is a polarity. The same reality poises itself doubly, soul and nature, the master and the power. Without these two terms, maybe the same reality, the same being, positing itself doubly, there is no creation, there is no manifestation. In the tantras, it is said that in the beginning there is only one, the Parashiva, the Supreme Shiva. When he gets into the mood to create, he poises himself as Shiva and Shakti. As you ascend also, once you decide, enough of this play, enough of this creation, through the two gates you pass into the Supreme, Absolute. So as far as the manifestation is concerned, there is the practical duality. Though essentially, they are not two, just as sun and sunlight, fire and heat. For practical purposes, we have to accept this working relation of duality. Cyril, you said some questions will be asked.
Yes. there came to the center a message, or rather a vision, that Mother had on Darshan Day of November in 1965. This was given by Mother to Rajuda to send to American centers on March, the month before she went into
retirement.
Yes, into retirement. It evidently was given with her foreknowledge that this was to be a directive when she went into retirement, and it contains something very important for those who are engaged in an active karma yoga, at the same time who want to do the yoga of the transformation. Which she says in the vision was shown to her as being done by only a few. That brings up the need of those in Oroville who want to do the yoga of transformation, but have to do it in very stringent circumstances of a very active yoga. As to the need for guidelines on how to do it.
Can you say what the vision was? I don't know what you're talking about.
Can you quote? I can't quote it because I...
But I have not brought it.
It's a very long vision.
Can you indicate something?
Well, the essence of it was that Sri Aurobindo showed the mother the order within the universe, every being having its particular place, and showing that there was no need to go out and change those who were satisfied with a light of a higher culture, of a harmony on a mental plane, because they were satisfied with the world and the plane of consciousness in which they moved, and to disturb that would not be right. That one must, if one is going to do the yoga of transformation, do it within his place, at his level.
It's true what you said, that mother was shown so many gradations of humanity in which there was one special gradation which had reached the acme of human development, mental culture, had even shed the last elements of animality, but was content with the highest possible mental attainment. It had no special seeking for transformation and divinization. Then there were others. So when she saw this sort of gradations, different kinds of people, different stages of evolution fitting in with different orders, she smiled at the attempt of preparing people. She said, only those who are ready and seek for a particular truth, they will get it. There must be first the aspiration. So those who do not have it, they should be left to their state. Am I right? They should be left to that state. Then she describes that there are some who are actively engaged in the yoga of transformation. They are working for it. There are also those who are contributing to the yoga of transformation, to this movement for transformation, in their own way, without doing that yoga themselves, by way of work, by way of goodwill, by helping in many ways. They themselves do not expect to get to participate in the gains of transformation. They know they are not fit for it. But all the same, they are putting their best. They are doing their karma yoga or whatever you say, contributing to it. So each category must respect the other. They must not impose their discipline, their sacrifice, standards of sacrifice on others. Each category must be left free to develop in its own way. I read it after you told me once again. It is perfectly, it is a vision that she had, and there she speaks that it is no use compelling a person to shed his animality when he is not ready for it. If he is still in the evolutionary stage, which is proper to the animal belt, it's no use compelling him to desist from certain actions which are natural to the animal stage. This is, I understood. But now, the question arises. If we are to follow the gradations hewn by nature, we have just to follow nature. It will take long time. But man is given a will. Man can expedite his evolution. Man can take a leap. So if I find that certain parts in me still respond to the urges of animality, but there are other parts which aspire higher, which want to cross the belt, certainly I am expected to exert my will, forcibly eliminate the inferior elements from my nature and catch up with the higher flame. Each sincere person is expected to do it, and he is given this help to do it. All that is expected is he shall not impose it on a third man, on another person. But each individual has a certain responsibility when he is given the opportunity. Do I make myself clear?
Yes. But in a community,
yes,
such as the one at Mata Mandir, there is a different set of conditions, and this brings up the question of imposition upon others and going outside of the sphere of one's own self-discipline. Mm. Here at Mata Mandir, it's the only settlement in Oroville that has a list of rules sent out with Mother's blessing for no sex indulgence, no tobacco, no drugs, so forth. Now, how is one, when Mother's expressed wishes in these matters is not followed, and when Mother has said also in reference to these injunctions that her help is available to any sincere person who wants to change, what should be the attitude of a member of the community towards this?
The very fact that Mother has framed these guidelines for those who stay in Mata Mandir, and she chooses certain individuals alone to stay here, necessarily means that they are in a stage when they can and should follow those guidelines. Otherwise, they forfeit the trust imposed in them by the Divine. It is the responsibility of each one to respond and follow up. Otherwise, the trust is betrayed. I have seen how she makes the selection. She, her selecting persons to stay here is different from her with. Behavior. Behavior on behalf of the persons she has chosen. Beyond that, each individual has no right to interfere with the course of life of another unless it cuts across the discipline of the community. Individual lives have to be are separate, but there is an area where the collective life starts. There things are different, and pressure can be exerted at that level. Either an opinion must be created, a powerful opinion, making it difficult for the offending element to continue, or it must be brought to the notice of mother. Whether she will allow the situation to continue as it is, or what she will do. Each individual has a certain responsibility to the collectivity here. That remark that one can't compel another doesn't hold good here. In that vision, it does not apply here, because this is a select community, this sort of a vanguard, which does not permit of sliding back.
Sentence or two from Nolini's book, Poets and Mystics. He says the pure aesthete is a closed system.
Pure?
Aesthete.
Ah.
It's a closed system with a consciousness immured in an ivory tower, but man is something more. A curious paradox. Man can reach the highest, realize the integral truth when he takes the leap. Takes his leap, not from the relatively higher levels of his consciousness, his intellectual and aesthetic and even moral status, but when he can do so from his lower levels, when the physical vital element in him serves as a springing board. The decent and the beautiful, the classic grace and aristocracy, form one aspect of man, the aspect of life, but the aspect of energy and power lies precisely in him where the aboriginal and the barbarian find also a lodger. Is it necessary that there be a step down?
No. At this context, I do not know the context. Power is originally divine. Love is divine. Light is divine, power is divine. It is only its perverted reflection in ignorance that becomes an energy of falsehood. Essentially, intrinsically, power is divine. Possibly, the seat of power in man, in a human being, is the vital. And the vital happens to be the most recalcitrant and aboriginal member of the human family. But as Sri Aurobindo has observed, the vital enlightened, the vital converted, is a hero of God, is a soldier of the divine. Without the vital falling in line, there is no manifestation. Mother has laid so much stress on the conversion of the vital, because the whole endeavor to bring the kingdom of heaven on earth is to be fed and supported by the complete participation of the vital, which is the vehicle of power. Simply because in its present stage, the vital happens to be blinded or primitive, you cannot convict it of eternal aboriginality. Power is neither moral nor immoral. It depends who uses it and why. Like electricity, use it for good purpose, peaceful purpose, you can use it for wrong purposes. Power is immoral. It is, Sri Aurobindo observed in that classic book, The Mother, power, money, sex, these are the three divine puissances which have been misused. Power is divine originally. We have to reclaim it for the divine.
Can the leap to the transformation be effectuated on aesthetic levels?
Yes, but it will be confined to the aesthetic sphere. And that level, it will be there, you will be linked. The value there will be different, the appreciation there will be different. But unless it is related dynamically to the rest of your being, the rest of the being can't share in that attainment. Many poets, seers, rishis have had this kind of transmutation in their high levels, but they are not made part of the life. An artist, painter, musician, at the summit, they do undergo that transmutation. They break through the human horizons, and that is why they bring to earth some glory from the heaven.
With the mother's withdrawal, isn't she teaching us how to walk by ourselves in her consciousness? And how can a matter be referred to her without treading upon the state that she wishes to be in that.
This withdrawal is temporary. It is temporary. And as you said, the presiding force is making use of this period to force people to feel the presence, force them to contact the central reality and govern themselves without being guided at every step. We have to wait. There are signs already of her resuming effective control of the work. She has said, it's only a couple of days ago, that she has been following an inner movement and she has arrived somewhere. The pressure is growing in a way that physical reference of things to her may not be found necessary at all.
Down by someone who's directly appointed by the mother as his superior, and what attitude one can adopt.
In the first place, we must assume bona fides of both the parties. The person who decides, executes, he must recognize the bona fides of those who differ from him. And the rest also must accept that the person in charge is doing things to the best of his lights. That's the best he can do. We may not agree with it, we may not think that's the right thing. But that is the best he can do. That we must accept. Now, when the question arises of difference, we must be frank enough to put it to the person. We feel it this way. If it is not possible at that time to put it before mother, we have to accept express our reservations, but still carry out what the person in charge asks us to do. Without it, no collective work can go on. If there are 100 individuals, there will be 90 opinions. We must have faith in the guiding power. All things ultimately fall into their proper positions. If the person in charge continues to do things really detrimentally to the interest of the work, you can trust to the guiding grace to effect the necessary changes in right time. When she puts somebody in charge, she always puts a force in the person to guide him, to guard him from error, to help him, and also to evoke that amount of loyalty from others which is necessary. How he uses that power is another question. In these matters, ultimately, it is a question of everybody's sincerity. Very thin line separates ego from the question of rightness or wrongness. Where it is my ego that feels hurt and finds justifications because my opinion is not accepted, and where it is the right thing that is revealed to me and the other fails to appreciate, it is a very difficult question. It's only an utmost honesty to oneself that can help.